conflict of interest. It's supposed to be the second slide in all our presentations, but there's a quick thing in the front. It sort of says it. Every session I've been at, people have been forgetting to put their second slide as a statement of their conflict of interest, but it is an APHA policy, and I think it's a good one. I also want to say that we, in our nearly 40 years of women's health education and advocacy work, did not come to the issue of what we call new reproductive technologies really till the early 1980s, and we had a chapter in that early, I guess, 1984 edition of Our Bodies, Ourselves entitled New Reproductive Technologies, and we began to look at the emerging debate about whether or not some of what we call ART techniques, assisted reproductive technology techniques, ought to be covered by third-party payers. And because we early on got involved in the whole evidence-based medicine movement, we turned to researchers who said, you know, you don't have a good basis for advocating third-party reimbursement here. This is all experimental. And we had already seen what happened with internal fetal heart, electronic fetal heart monitoring. It became the standard of care. You know, they were putting those electrodes in the fetal scalp, pretty much spread across the country. And then the famous Albert Haverkamp study, and they did the what we call technology assessment of the internal fetal heart monitor. And it came so late that they could not go back easily and change what was then standard medical practice. So we were already seeing examples of why it's so important at the outset to ask good questions. And we were very unpopular in Massachusetts when we took a position against third-party mandates for some of the IVF procedures that were coming down the pike. But it also heightened our awareness about these kinds of issues. Now, we all along have been concerned about what goes on in the IVF context. In the around 2001, stem cell researchers and those in the field of scientific research came to us. They saw we had advocated in related issues, and they said, you really need to do something in the area of gathering eggs for stem cell research, particularly somatic cell nuclear transfer. And we were totally supportive of embryonic stem cell research using otherwise discarded embryos from IVF clinics, but we actually began to look at the fact that still we don't have what we could call real informed consent, and you don't have a case for the benefit that you could make in the embryo stem cell research context that you could have in the IVF context, because right now, 30-40% of the time, if you've got a decent clinic, you're going to end up with somebody having a baby. And those are in the best clinics, some are worse. But that's a benefit that's tangible. In the somatic cell nuclear transfer setting, with that kind of embryo stem cell research, the benefits are way more distant, and you can argue you need much better informed consent. We want it for everybody. But that brought us into this field of discourse, and we have had some very eye-opening conversations with both stem cell researchers, many of whom are quite honest, and I have to say that those in California and Massachusetts who wanted to see more women donate eggs also felt like there shouldn't be $4,000, $5,000, $7,000, $8,000, which is the lowest amount you'd get if you were in the IVF context. They wanted to see no payment beyond covering of, you know, your basic costs, as you've heard. And with that as the backdrop, how many women volunteered there to provide eggs in Massachusetts for stem cell research? Zero. And I think in California it's been equally difficult, maybe one. I know that it's been rather extraordinary. Well, they use a 17-page informed consent document in Massachusetts. It's quite thorough. They're also very careful not to hyperstimulate with too much drugs, so they'll reduce the risk of ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about some of the medical risks here, and then I'll see a few sort of summary points as well. The extraction procedure is pretty much the same with various alterations. Whether you're going to be going through the process of producing eggs for somebody else, if you're a young woman providing eggs as an egg donor, or you're doing it for yourself, say in an IVF clinic, you're extracting your own eggs. Initially, unless you are one of these fairly uncommon circumstances where you do a lot of research and you don't want any part of the hormonal manipulations. What you want to do is simply harvest the single egg you produce that month, which means following your hormonal signs and, you know, harvesting that egg no matter what time of day or night it occurs, and you only get one chance to fertilize and implant. But there are individuals who want to do that approach for infertility. They don't get involved at all in this. But for most people, what they do is they first suppress ovulation so that then you can have controlled hyperstimulation of the ovaries to produce multiple follicles, number of eggs. Then you harvest these mature eggs, you extract them, and then you move on to fertilize them in a petri dish, and then you hopefully have embryos that you can implant in somebody later who's going to go to term for a baby, whether as a woman who will give her baby up for adoption, basically contract motherhood or whatever you want to call it, surrogacy, or you're the person whose egg was gathered because you have, say, tubal occlusion and you really needed to have that embryo put right into the uterus. Okay, so ovulation suppression is largely performed with a drug called Lupron, luprolide acetate. I am not going to read all of these side effects. I will say that the ones that seem to appear more often when the Lupron Victims Network, which is a group of women who discovered them one another on the internet, and throughout the late 90s and even into 2000, I forget when this website was brought down, there are things like brain fog, loss of memory, depression, certain kinds of vision problems that came up over and over again. And then, of course, joint pain was huge. What is of interest is that for some of these women, the joint pain and the side effects didn't go away long after, you know, the drug would have been out of the body. And that is something that has caused some concern amongst endocrinologists that I know. Now, luprolide acetate is not the only drug used to suppress ovulation. Something called Antagon is used, and that actually has FDA approval for this purpose. This is more popular, but this does not have FDA approval. This is all off-label use, which is one of the things many people don't know when they go through these procedures. So then the hyperstimulation of the ovaries is actually better studied. You produce as many as 10 to 30 eggs. We know that the worst problem associated with hyperstimulating ovaries is something called ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, when the ovary sacs fill up with fluid and they form cysts that can rupture. Sometimes this fluid leaks out. It can happen in a matter of hours. It is life-threatening if you're not monitored closely. And usually you get some pretty strong symptoms. Something's wrong. This is most often dealt with and adequately treated in a hospital setting. There are a few documented cases of deaths from ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. Then, of course, the extraction procedure is very minor. There's some pain associated during the surgery, maybe for a few days afterwards, but this is not the part of the whole procedure that has raised concerns. Now, this is the big question. Long-term effects. We really don't know what they are. And there are all these problems that have been, experienced. We don't know whether they're really related to the use of drugs, which drugs. We need better research here. And one of the things that I want to point to is that for the first time since we have followed this issue, and we have, you know, been in touch with people at the CDC, they had a very interesting symposium on infertility in September, and there will be some proceedings coming out, and that had all the stakeholders at the table, members of SART, Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology, ASRM, American Society for Reproductive Medicine, and some of the advocacy groups there, and a number of researchers. But until this physician, Jennifer Schneider, got this piece published in a very recent issue of Fertility and Sterility, which is the ASRM publication, there was nothing really in the medical literature that documented the need for better research and really went through a lot of the things you'll see here and there and said, you know, we have got to do a better job of gathering information so that young women can make a truly informed decision here. I'm just going to read the beginning of this article, and she was really alarmed because in her article she points out the fact that up to 100,000 young American women have donated or sold their eggs to fertility clinics. This is a very large number of women. So she begins this. She basically introduced this as a case report so she could get it published. "I've decided to be an egg donor," my daughter told me on the phone. She had read posters and newspaper advertisements on campus seeking egg donors and thought it would be a good way to assert her financial independence. Also, she had also hoped to have children and was drawn to the idea of helping other women. Jessica was precisely the kind of young woman the advertisers were targeting. She was an honors student at an elite university, multi-talented, athletic, tall, attractive, and had a healthy lifestyle. She did not smoke, she exercised and danced, and she was a vegetarian. I was concerned, but after all, she was an adult, free to make her own choices. "The most important thing is your safety," I told her, responding both as her mother and as a physician. "Don't worry, Mom," she assured me. "The agency told me it's safe, and they use a reputable IVF clinic and experienced doctors. I know there's the usual small risk of bleeding or infection from the egg retrieval, but otherwise they say there's no problem." The protocol used was a typical one for that time. It included Luprolide, 250 milligrams subcutaneously twice a day for 2 to 3 weeks, Pergonal, 3 ampoules per day, and HCG, human chorionic gonadotropin, 10,000 units intramuscularly. The first cycle went smoothly and a pregnancy resulted from it. Shortly thereafter, the agency contacted her about a second recipient. Jessica was about to move from one coast of the United States to the other, so she initially declined. But this time, because she was a proven egg donor, the agency offered her significantly more money. It was too good to turn down. And all she did, 3 egg retrieval cycles in a few months, other pregnancies resulted. Fast forward 4 years, Jessica was now a grad student in filmmaking as well as a composer. Returning from a holiday in Japan, she began to complain of abdominal cramps. An attempted colonoscopy failed because of severe intestinal obstruction. A computed tomography scan of her abdomen revealed tumor involvement of her colon and both ovaries, as well as peritoneal carcinomatosis. Histologic analysis of biopsy specimens confirmed widespread colon cancer. 2 years later, after chemotherapy surgery and palliative radiation for bone and brain metastases, Jessica died in July 2003. She was 31 years old. Subsequent DNA testing of her tissue revealed no genetic predisposition to colon cancer. So she went on and she started thinking, you know, maybe if I, you know, raise this issue, something will happen like happened after the death of Jesse Gelsinger, the 18-year-old Arizona resident who was killed during experimental treatment for gene therapy for a rare genetic disorder. And after that, there was cessation of human experiments with genetic alterations until more studies would be done. She was also concerned that so many young women were not understanding. As she said, most women don't understand that there's a huge difference between being told, "We don't know of any significant long-term risks," and "There are no significant long-term risks." And very often, women are told there are no significant long-term risks. Women recruited at university campuses all over the United States clearly need protection from the coercive influences of the marketplace. And she was arguing that the profession would be seen to be complicit in all of this unless it took a more proactive stand and seeking the kind of data we need. So she's actually asking that the print and electronic media, who are crucial in recruiting potential donors, should be approached by regulatory authorities to include mention of the likelihood of the short and long-term risks that are inherent in egg donation. She wants to point out that there are egg-sharing schemes whereby women undergoing IVF for themselves can share their eggs with others, so, and there are many couples who do that, so there is another vehicle. And she wants the CDC to immediately start a registry of egg donors, including both infertile women seeking to become pregnant or becoming pregnant, and women who are selling or donating eggs, whether to produce a baby or for stem cell research. She pointed out in her article that no professional body in the U.S. has initiated a systematic follow-up of paid or altruistically motivated volunteer egg donors. And one of the key things we have to remember is most of these previous studies have included infertile women rather than young egg donors with no suspected or known fertility problems. They may be important characteristic differences between women who are infertile and women who are healthy providing eggs. Dr. Suzanne Parisian, former chief medical officer at the FDA, wrote in 2005, after we asked her to, a two-page document pointing out that most of the drugs used during these procedures have not been monitored for long-term safety, that these firms have not been required by either government or physicians to collect safety data for IVF drugs regarding things like risk of cancer or other serious health conditions. And we have shared that letter with a number of policymakers. We also point out that there are numerous adverse drug reactions reported to the FDA. I have not followed up in the last few years, but there are some grad students who may be following up and doing a report that will look at this. You cannot tell why in any given instance someone had a problem or even that someone died. It may have nothing to do with the drug. You need to follow up and look more carefully at these reports. But there's an indicator we may have a problem here. And of course, I just had to throw in one of these ads. They get up to $80,000 or $100,000 in some places, so there's some considerable incentive there. For those of you who are interested, I did bring along a few of the examples of popular press. There's a lot of it right now. You can Google it, but I'm going to leave these up here. This is an article from the WIP, Women's International Perspective, an article by Preeta Sehgal, Reproductive Tourism Soars in India, Adoption and Surrogacy Catch Up. Something from the Straits Times in India. These are both from October of this year. Okay to Rent Womb in India. This is about the court ruling in a new bill that will legalize an industry worth about $445 million. I also have Deborah Spar's piece, The Perspective in the New England Journal of Medicine, back in February 2005, entitled Reproductive Tourism and the Regulatory Map. Also back in 2005 in USA Today, Reproductive Tourism, and, you know, headings like Honey, Your Eggs Are Old, which is the beginning of marketing to many infertile couples the idea that you are better off, and in fact there's evidence that you are better off using the eggs of a younger woman. The Life Factory in India, surrogacy has become a global business. India's surrogate mother industry, this is BBC News. And then a Reuters piece from July of this year, experts say reproductive tourism a growing worry. And that's where one of the few articles where you saw some of these advantages and disadvantages. So I'll stop there, and if you want more information about some of the groups that we're working with who are doing their own translation adaptations of Our Bodies, Our Cells, like in Israel and other countries, you can pick up our brochure and go to our website. Some of these groups are actually looking at this issue in more depth and maybe including it in their adaptations of Our Bodies, Our Cells. Why don't I just go with everybody?
We can hear your stomachs grumbling from up here, but we have a few minutes, so we can just open it up if there are any questions for any of the panelists or thoughts that you want to, you don't have to just ask questions, you can tell us what you think, because I think that's really important. Sometimes people have to pretend they have a question, so please offer your thoughts. Yes. Who wants to? The question is the intersection between looking at surrogacy and work. What happens if you are injured or you have some health impact from being a surrogate, and do you get paid minimum wage? What is that intersection?
You know, I think they're really looking at this more as an altruistic act, and in fact, part of the motivation, and then because it is so enormous what you're doing, you get some compensation, but I don't think they view it quite like, a typical job where you get an hourly wage. The altruism is always in there, and in fact, when they screen, they want to make sure that that's a component of why a woman is doing it.
Well, even, I guess we should probably...
I just passed out, it's taped.
I was speaking with a psychologist at an IVF clinic, and she said, I mean, they are basically, when they screen all the women who are thinking about egg donation go through a psychological screening, and one of the things that the psychologist asks is, what are your motivations? And if they're only doing it for the money, then they're not, supposedly, they're not chosen. Though, I mean, as Judy said, they got zero women to donate eggs for research in Massachusetts and zero or one in California, and so clearly, if you could go here and do it for no money and here and do it for a lot of money and up to 100,000 women have done it for money and zero have done it for no money, you know that there's motivation around. I mean, not to say that women aren't also doing it for altruistic reasons as well. Clearly they are. But just that there is definitely that component. So I think Judy's right, is that it's kind of compensation for your time or for your efforts, but it's not payment. You're not allowed to pay for it necessarily.
And I just want to add, the injury part, usually it's all a matter of contract. So what happens, all of that is in a contractual document, and these agreements are enforced just like regular contracts, as if you were hiring a roofer to fix your house.
What's very interesting is that couples really vary, and their and even within the couple, their interest in being parents to a child without a biological relationship. And there are cases, I know of many cases where the woman, interestingly enough, was just fine with adopting, and her partner did not want that. Her partner really wanted to have a genetic connection. And when I think couples know that it's really important to be on the same page on that issue, because sometimes people have like given in and to the other partner and it's caused conflict. So I think it depends on the individuals. There are people who've written about their experience. There's a Harvard law professor, Elizabeth Barthelet, who wrote a book about how she really wasn't even encouraged to think about adoption at first. She went through a lot of IVF. In the end, she did adopt. It was a good experience. And she wrote about how she wished somebody had more even-handedly offered it as an option. So she was concerned about the counseling at the front end, that she didn't get what she thought was good counseling. And in her case, it wasn't a matter of partner resistance. So each situation is a little different. But adoption is happening a lot for couples, and certainly for gay couples and single women, much more in other countries than it used to. And people are traveling to places like Kazakhstan, and where they've set up adoption systems that hopefully, for the parents coming, or the women and the men coming, are going to guard against the exploitation of the women, like we saw in Latin America for more than a decade. Huge problems with babies being stolen from poor women and then, you know, made available to couples seeking adoption. You want to make sure that you're getting a child that was really surrendered by the mother of her own volition.
One source you might want to look at, it's a law review article by Susan Freilich Appleton. And she puts up sort of different ways of forming a family with a child on a spectrum in terms of how heavily they're regulated. And there is a correlation between the level of regulation and the sort of the access or desirability of that particular means. So on the one hand, it's the least regulated form, sexual conception. Right? And on the other hand, the most heavily regulated form of family formation with a child is probably domestic agency-based adoption, right? But second next to sexual conception is ARTs. Transnational adoption is probably in between ARTs and domestic agency-based adoption. But it depends on the country that you're going to. And so people are going to particular countries, which goes back to the point that somebody made earlier, that there are comparisons to be made between transnational adoptions and reproductive tourism.
I just want to add, this is one of the imponderable questions, is the what is that drive to have a biological child? And is this biology? Is it socialization? We can think back two generations where adopting a child was shameful because it reflected on whether or not you were a real woman, whether or not you could conceive. And so I think that's one of the big questions in here is, like, what is that? Here and then there, yes.
Yeah, I mean, the question was about the identity release and what are the implications for children who are born through assisted reproductive technologies who might not know their origins of who their donors are. And there's been a lot of debate on this. In particular, there's a lot of debate happening right now in Canada with a move towards, Canada right now has, I'm trying to remember what their current status. I think that their current status is that it can be anonymous, right? And people are trying to move towards more identity release in Canada exactly for the reasons people have talked about around adoption, of the importance of people knowing their parentage or their, you know, biological origins. So I can't say very much about it, and Judy might be able to comment
in
a little
Denmark,
more.
Some of the Scandinavian countries, like in Denmark as well, require that if you're a man providing sperm, that you give the information about who you are, so then any offspring that comes of your sperm will be able to get information about you when they're older.
Not Denmark, though. I think Denmark has anonymity.
The
and the other
is
ones.
It's definitely part of the UK.
No, there is
now
a Scandinavian
right, well,
country.
Right, well, Norway, Sweden, and the Netherlands all require identity release, and that's why people are sometimes going to Denmark. But, yeah, so I wasn't so much commenting on sort of the value of whether it was good or bad, but I think that that's an important point, is there is a lot of conversation, and a lot of times the children born through these technologies get left out of the entire debate. I mean, first the women get left out. You know, a lot of times, especially with things like not even assisted reproduction, but stem cell research, there's all the stuff about eggs needed, but nobody ever talked about where they were coming from. And when you're talking about assisted reproduction, a lot of times people are not talking about the egg donors themselves or the surrogates, and people are definitely not even talking about what's happening with the children who are born, and are they being told that they were conceived through donor eggs or sperm, and what does it mean to not have identity released for biological parents? So.
Two more questions.
Cindy? Thank you. I hope that you will want to participate. We have time for just a couple more questions, so one here, and then I think we have to break. Yeah, well, The first thing, just in terms of legal parentage, the legal parentage really doesn't attach until birth. So, but what you raise is really important questions about how much is that woman who is a surrogate, is she a vessel? Can she make her own choices? In India, many of the surrogacy systems are, at this point, the women are very highly regulated in terms of their behaviors. Sometimes they have to leave their families and live in a surrogate house where they are monitored, what they eat, what they do. And so I think that's a tremendous question of I think generally it's going to depend on what the contract says. I mean, we are reducing these important questions of dignity and humanity to contract law, but also the country in which this is happening. And one more. I'm sorry, did you want to say something about that?
Yeah.
I don't think we know the answer to that, but I will tell you that Takeda Abbott Pharmaceuticals actually began a trial because they were going after FDA approval. And a year and a half into the trial, they stopped the trial. And they decided that they really didn't need FDA approval because there was already brisk off-label use. I don't think they liked what they saw. And I think that it's no accident there was this group called the Lupron Victims Network, and I don't think that it's any accident we're seeing even some of the younger women who are egg donors speaking out now. Not in large numbers, but there are a few students who've gone and done these homemade films, and one of them actually has done a film called All in One Basket that Fanlight Productions is distributing. It's not as thorough, but it gets at some of these issues. And I think that the IVF field itself has long been reluctant to look at this, and it's one of the reasons we pushed for the CDC meeting, and I hope that CDC will respond because of Jennifer Schneider's very impassioned plea. We can't tell these young women what they need to know so they can make an informed choice, and in particular about what happens when you're shutting down the ovaries, and particularly if you're doing it multiple cycles. Maybe one time isn't such a big deal, but there's all this evidence about threshold responses we have to the administering of drugs of any sort. And if you're doing this three times and, you know, in a few months, you may pass a certain threshold and then you have a really adverse outcome that you can't correct or, you know, alleviate. I am actually a little distressed that more members in the IVF field haven't publicly said what some of them have said to me privately, and I can't quote any of them because it was all off record. And I have to say that it has disturbed me, and I believe that people like Deborah Spar and others who have been writing about this, who call it the cowboys of the Wild Wild West or something like that, that this is basically an unregulated field that is doing a lot of things that really should be more closely monitored. And it's, you know, I mean, this is everyone's assumption, but I would like to see something change. There are now so many more ads, and I do a lot of speaking on college campuses about other issues, but I always ask about this, and many, many young women have come forward and said, yeah, I did it, or I was about to do it, and then I talked to someone and I changed my mind. It's a hot issue, and now if you saw the recent press, because of the downturn in the economy, there's been a huge uptake in young women who are doing egg donation to get money to pay for their educational expenses because they don't have other means. So this gets to the question of undue financial incentives or inappropriate financial incentives. And although I do believe in autonomy, I also think that we have to look carefully at whether or not for anybody, you know, getting money or not getting money, you can really give informed choice on this issue. And that's why the single cycling folks, I meet these couples who are physicians and, you know, nurses and lawyers, they're the ones who like have said, you know, we're going to do this, but we're not going there. We're just going to get the egg we produce and see what luck we have. It's very interesting.
Thank you.
I just want to make a quick announcement. I know it's lunchtime and people have other sessions to go to. But we have an Emerging Reproductive Technologies Task Force as part of the Population, Family Planning, and Reproductive Health section. So if you're interested, come talk to me. We'll be organizing a panel for next year's session. And also have an online resource that there's the web address is here about an overview of assisted reproductive technologies using a reproductive justice framework. So, and Judy has some articles, so feel free to come on up and talk to us.
And watch the California Legislative Health Committee, because there's interest now in doing this registry, even if CDC doesn't. Yeah.
So I want to thank our presenters. And thank you all for participating.
100 seasons since we had a championship.
That's exciting.
On the one hand,